This time of year, you're going to find me jigging for crappies off my father-in-law's boat, celebrating a successful turkey hunt, or just sitting on the back deck watching time go by with a quality cigar from Thompson Cigar. Thompson Cigar has been around since 1915, offering the widest array of cigars and cigar accessories at very affordable prices. Thompson Cigar offers your favorite brands like Swisher Sweets, Cohiba, Backwoods, and Monte Cristo shipped fresh directly to your door. Also, be sure to check out their 5-pack fever deals and join their value club for big savings. Visit thompsoncigar.com and enter the discount code SE at checkout for 20% off of all orders over $75. Thompson Cigar, quality cigars at affordable prices. You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.
Two Good & Co. coffee creamers are made with farm-fresh cream, real milk, and contain 3 grams of sugar per serving. That's 40% less than the 5 grams per serving in leading traditional coffee creamers for a rich, delicious experience. Whether you enjoy your coffee hot, cold, bold, or frothy, Two Good coffee creamers make every sip a good one. Two Good coffee creamers, real goodness in every sip. Find them at your local Kroger in the creamer aisle.
Where's your playlist taking you? Down the highway? To the mountains? Or just into daydream mode while you're stuck in traffic? With over 4,000 hotels worldwide, Best Western is there to help you make the most of your getaway. Wherever that is. Because the only thing better than a great playlist is a great trip. Life's the trip. Make the most of it at Best Western. Book direct and save at bestwestern.com.
The world moves fast. Your workday, even faster. Pitching products, drafting reports, analyzing data. Microsoft 365 Copilot is your AI assistant for work. Built into Word, Excel, PowerPoint, and other Microsoft 365 apps you use. Helping you quickly write, analyze, create, and summarize. So you can cut through clutter and clear a path to your best work. Learn more at Microsoft.com/M365 Copilot.
Hey guys, before we start, a quick shout out to Alpha Dog Nutrition for sponsoring this podcast. Alpha Dog products are now available at dusupply.com, and you can use code ALPHADOG15 at checkout for 15% off and a credit for free shipping to try it yourself. Now let's get you to your podcast.
Dogs, you know, have an innate ability to exhibit behavior consistent with their expectation of being reinforced. Instead of doing a sit or doing a down or backing away to do a down or any number of things that we taught them initially that we had to correct them off of later. Well, if they never learn to do it the wrong way, it's pretty easy to understand why they do it the right way each time. Mm-hmm. It's like the dog that you let outside to go use the bathroom to relieve himself. They always do that little behavior that they do just before they drop a deuce. And you're able to tell it 15, 20 seconds before it actually happens. And the level of accuracy with that is close to 100%. Mm-hmm. If we can find dogs who's close to 100% on their final response, then that's what we're looking for. And it works out pretty well just to let them pick out what it is. And usually, and I think you've heard me say it before, it was that almighty look. Everybody gets so concerned. The dog's looking at me. Oh, my God, he's looking. You know, at the end of the day, if he's expecting to be paid for what he just did and he knows where it's coming from, that looking back at me is only time he ever does that. That's all right with me for a final response.
Welcome to my podcast, where we are going to talk about a lifestyle with dogs and throw in a few life lessons along the way. Whether you're a hound hunter, a bird dog enthusiast running setters, pointers, retrievers, or a flat-out running dog junkie, this podcast is for you. I am your host, Heath Hyatt, a certified law enforcement canine trainer with over 3 decades of personal and professional training and handling experience. it's time for me to pay it forward. So grab your leads, lace up those boots, and come and join me on this lifelong process of teaching, training, and learning all types of hunting dogs. Do you like to be outdoors like I do? Hunting, fishing, hiking? If so, OnX is the app for you. I've been a loyal OnX user since 2013. It's the one app I can honestly say I use daily. While hunting, I know where I'm at all times. I mark trails, feeding, bedding areas, and the list goes on. When I'm traveling, I use it to pre-scout all the new places that I'm blessed to hunt. While out west hiking Yellowstone, I knew exactly where every trail went and the difficulty of each one. And here's a secret. I even use it to mark my favorite fishing spots. It's been a game changer at work. I've used it numerous times to get in touch with property owners. I even landed MedFlight one time in the middle of nowhere using the GPS coordinates. OnX has so many great features and tools, you can literally use it for everything. It is by far the best mapping app on the market. So get started with OnX today using K920. That's the letter K, number 920, and know where you stand.
A total cease and desist of all forward progress and behavior consistent with the expectation of being reinforced.
I have learned that through my travels, my schools, my contacts, my mentors that I have been so fortunate to have throughout my canine career, which is nowhere near being over because I'm still learning every day, that there's one thing that is common. And I have had several people on this podcast that have got, they're in the canine or training world that all revert back to some type of hound sport. And today's going to be no different. I am honored to have this guest on. I mean, he's a professional dog trainer with over 40 years. He has been on national TV. He was on a late night show with Letterman. And I know some of you young guys that listen to the show will not have any clue who David Letterman is, but he was on it. And he has wrote numerous articles for canine magazines across the country. News. I mean, he's been on major news appearances. The wealth of knowledge that is sitting in front of me right now is it's undeniable, and it's a big part of the reason that my group, our group in the Newer Valley, has been as successful as they have. We had him up in this is March 2016, so it's been 8 years ago that he was up, spent a week with us, and back then they called it the On Target. And we learned a lot about odor and dogs and behavior and predicting behavior and understanding behavior. And this is one of the first classes that kind of started propelling me into a better place as being a handler and learning to be a trainer. So we have got Mr. Randy Hare from Jackson, Mississippi. So we got him on today, and we're going to be talking about a lot of different things, but Randy has been very influential in me and what I do, even though it was just one short week that I spent with him. We have talked several times throughout the 8 years, and I have learned so much from him that, like I said, I still use some of his techniques that we are going to talk about. Some of the stuff that I learned from him on dog behavior, we just had a short conversation about understanding some things. So, Randy, I'm going to let you introduce yourself a little bit more, and I want you to go back to the 70s, because that's how long it's been, guys, in the 70s, when Randy was running some beagles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's that's how I first got started into dogs. It's course, like most everybody else, you have dogs as a child, as kids, and when you come up, you kind of talk about the experiences and that. Nothing was really outstanding, you know, as far as coming up and being a kid and having dogs like Cocker Spaniels and Chihuahuas and stuff of that nature. But when I signed a football scholarship at Northeast Louisiana University called the University of Louisiana Monroe, now they were pretty much getting beat all the time. And I see through checking the records, they still are. But getting out of college, I wanted to delve into hunting again because I hadn't had a whole lot of time to do it. So I bought me two beagles, one male, one female, litter mates, $35 a piece.
Back then, that was a lot.
Big money back then. Well, big money.
Uh-huh. It was high dollar.
But $35 a piece. And, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to educate these dogs, how to get them to where they understand what's going on. I had to have these dogs where they would follow that rabbit and chase it, and hopefully I would be able to shoot it. And didn't have a clue as to what to do as far as the training goes. And shoot, we were out in the woods one afternoon. It was the dogs were 6 months old to the day at that time. And I'm looking at them, they're over there scratching themselves and doing the different things that the puppies do. And I'm sitting there on one of these stumps trying to figure out, you know, what to do to get these dogs trained. And it was obvious I didn't know a darn thing about training a dog. And, you know, still learn every day. But it was just a short period of time there, and I heard one of the dogs scream. And they were standing over there by a brush pile. And close to it, one was kind of on the other side where I couldn't see. But I heard that one scream. Another one ran around. I said, it's probably gotten on a snake or something. So I get up to go over there and look. And about the time I get to it, all hell breaks loose inside this thing. This huge rabbit that's bigger than both of those dogs put together came charging out of that brush pile. And they took in behind him, raising nine kinds of hell. Buddy, I had been born a dog trainer right then. I don't know how it happened, but it did. So I must have done it. No. That was in that happened when the sperm hit the egg. It's either there or it's not. And if it is there, you almost can't take it out of them. If it's not there, there's not much you can do to put it there. So you have to have a dog that wants to do this. You know, it happens genetically, and there's not a whole heck of a lot that you have to do other than, you know, maybe take them off of chasing deer or something. But, you know, I was excited as heck to see those dogs take off after that rabbit. And I started getting worried because I did not know at the time that the rabbit would go out there and make a turn and come back. I thought I was fixing to lose my $70 investment. And, you know, I hear this noise start coming, and the dogs are getting closer and closer and closer. So what's this about? And the rabbit comes and he runs right by me. It looked like he kind of looked at me, went like this, and just went right on.
He gave you the head nod. I'm out of here. Yeah, I'm out of here.
Yeah. Well, anybody with a last name of Harris is going to do that. Probably. But I see the dogs coming now. And the dogs are coming, and I remember the path that this rabbit took coming toward me, and I was able to see them work, and I see the nose working, and they were raising, you know, their cadence or whatever you want to call it. They were raising nine kinds of hell coming after that rabbit when they were on the track, but when they were off the track, not so much. They worked to get back on it, and then you heard them bellowing again, and here they go. And they go out and they do another big, and they come back. And here comes the same rabbit. You know, he's a little more tired now than he was before. But he gets close. He stops and looks at me. And I was able to shoot him. And one of the few times I was ever able to hit one. But I hit him, killed him instantly. And I'm looking at him the whole time. I said, man, I sure hate to be in your little paws because those dogs are getting closer and closer. Well, the dogs came up. They sniffed at the rabbit a little bit, checked him out, pushed him around a little bit. Nothing happened. They're off, and in 2 minutes' time, they had another one up running it. And it dawned on me, it's not about the food. They left that more than 2,000 years ago of domestication has caused them not to look at, you know, the quarry as the food, because they depend on us now for that. Mm. They love the game. And it was that game that was more important to them. than sitting there and trying to eat that rabbit. And I guess we killed four or five rabbits that day and never had to worry about them tearing the rabbit up or trying to eat it. They wanted the game.
It's about the chase.
And there's something exciting about that every time you do it. It gets in your blood as it has yours. And I finally got a chance about 6 years ago to, I did a school in Utah, and a guy by the name of Jeremy Foreman, who has some nice hounds, somebody you need to talk to and interview also, be a good interview for you. Good dude. And he calls me and said, look, we found some tracks. We're going to come by and pick you up. I said, oh, okay, where are we going? they were going mountain lion hunting. And of course, you could see on the Garmin exactly where the dogs were. And it wasn't long where they had this cat tree. And we had to run about 200 yards, I guess, up in the woods there to get to the tree. And it was on the side of this mountain, which you've described a couple of times. It's pretty steep. And they're raising heck down up under this tree. And you look up in the tree and there's this big, beautiful cat, man, just gorgeous mountain lion up there looking down at all those hounds. And I guess there were six hounds there. And I caught myself watching this as they sit there and let the dogs get full of this and have their fun. I'm sitting there watching it, and every dog was a little bit different in their cadence. One of them would sit there and he would have a different cadence of bellowing, you know, and his own style of doing thing. And then I had one who would jump up and grab a limb, and the limb would almost always break because he'd grab a small one. And he would come down and roll about halfway down that mountain, get back up and come back up and do the same darn thing. I said, he's going to kill himself. But it was interesting in watching each one of those dogs. And I don't know how many people watched that closely, but every one of them was different in a way. Every one of them had a slightly different final response that nobody taught.
How each dog is different. And when you're talking about that, that's what I'm like. I still remember you talking about that stuff.
Yeah, it's give a good example of Nexus. You see these border collies, and you'll see a 14-week-old Kelpie in a video. You see them all over the place, and they're out there herding these sheep like nobody's business. Or maybe they start them on ducks. And the Nexus that I'm talking about is how to get the dog to do what he's already doing under your pretense. To do enough training to show them that I want the flock to come this way or the herd to come this way, and adding that to it without messing up the innate ability. And when we can do that, we're ahead of the game. Bird dogs, they already know how to point. You see that all the time in these litters. They'll drop a feather down in front of them, and all, you know, maybe all of them, but maybe two that didn't get gifted with the genetics, you know, will sit there and point. And it's weird because you see them as adult dogs, they'll point and then they'll move a little bit and then they'll stop and point again. Then they'll move a little bit and stop and point again. Well, is that because they're getting anxious, or is that because they're out of odor? And to get back into odor is the thing that causes them to give that point. And it's kind of cool when you realize that they can do this and you don't have to do a bunch of training about it. Then we start messing with it and tweaking it so we can win a trophy and there's some competition. And that's where we go beyond the Nexus and start messing things up sometimes. That makes any sense. It does. But the Nexus is us being smart enough to realize what the dog brings to the table, add what we bring to the table, be able to have a nice meal.
You had talked before about, you know, the dogs are training us.
They are. And once we get to the point to where we can learn from the dogs and not have to listen to a bunch of people who are, you know, kind of doing guesswork at to some extent, you know, it gets a little bit easier for us to understand. I trust what a dog shows me more so than what I have most humans.
Yeah.
There are some good trainers out there, and I've learned from a lot of good people. But there's some goobers too, you know, and as you're coming up, you know, you're trying to find your way, and it's almost like you're blind. You're trying to find your way, and you pick the people that you want to listen to because you figure they've been in it for a while. They've learned a little something. And I encourage everybody to learn from all of these people who know something, and but realize too that a lot of what they tell you may not apply to the dog that you have or the dog that you're going to have. So yeah, learning all of these different concepts, and then you start realizing that if this guy over here would talk to this guy over here, they might have something that they could put together, but they won't because the ego keeps them away from each other. Mm. And, you know, it's
So walk us back how the Beagles got you into the, you went from Beagles into the police world.
And well, it was at that time people were coming to me and said, look, I just bought me a couple of Beagles. Will you train them? I said, I don't do that for other people. I just do it for myself there only because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And
I feel like that all the time.
Yeah. So I decided in 1983, I guess it was, that I was going to go to a professional dog training school and learn how to train dogs professionally. And they still got them all over the place now, you know, going to. And back at that time, they were teaching strictly, strictly compulsion. Mm-hmm. It was all about the dog figuring out how to stop the compulsion. And, you know, when it came around to dogs learning through influence, you know, and I had people ask me, one guy actually trained dolphins, and he says, it just seems to me that if you did this another way with something that the dog wanted, you know, they would learn without all that pressure. And I said, no, you can't do that because of this or that. And I had been misinformed. Mm-hmm. And that's when I decided, you know, after competing in a police dog trial and something went, you know, wrong with that trial, that I decided I wasn't going to compete anymore and try to measure my manhood against other people's manhood, you know, through the dogs. You know, I wanted them right for the street, wanted them to be successful on the street. And that's what I worked on. I had to realize that going to the same place all the time for in-service training is doo-doo if you don't get out in the world. And every time you work your dog, you work him in a place he's never been before, because he's never going to make a case, find a bomb, find some dope. Yeah. You know, find cadaver, you know, in places that he's familiar with. It's going to be unfamiliar places. So train in those unfamiliar places. You know, get the dog ready to perform in an environment that he's not going to be familiar with, but at that time it doesn't matter. And you see him all the time going to these places, you know, where they go once a week, and they put five hides out in one room, and they direct the dog around, and they keep going. Even if the dog tries to go another direction, they'll pull him back. No, check here, check here, check here. They're directing the dog the whole time. And even when they smell something coming from across the room, or God forbid, coming from the ceiling, they do not have the freedom to be obedient to the odor and follow it to the source. Get the hell out of the way and let the dog do it. There's one expert in that room, and it ain't us.
That's why we got him to do the work.
That's my boy.
That's right. You told us that. That's why you bought the dog, not for you to do it, so he can do it.
Yeah. But the nexus changes. It shifts because we try to do too much. And now we're putting the dog in a position where he's making mistakes that we actually caused, that we're actually punishing him for. And that's the reason we have the low level of success that we have. There has to be an understanding. We're a team. I'm the chauffeur. I'm the delivery boy. I bring your payload to you when you're at the right place. But as far as me going there with you and trying to show you what to do and to show you how to do some sort of a final response is doo-doo.
Yeah. No, that we.
To me. That's my opinion anyway.
No, and like I told you, we switched up a lot of the stuff that we did, and we still continue to, like I said, I told you I'm two dogs removed since you've been here, and I'm still using the same ending. And, you know, I want to talk about the process. I don't want to jump all over the place because I got so many things that I want to talk about with you. But, you know, one of the things that I learned from you is it's a process. A lot of times it's not about the ending. It's about how you got there or where you're at. And I have really taken that into my hound training that, you know, I'm just looking for those little tidbits. I'm looking for a little bit of behavior here or a little bit of behavior here, or how can I help or do I need to get out of the way? Can you, I want you to elaborate a little bit on that, because that's something that I did take from you when you were here.
Well, you know, it has to do with the environment. There are certain environments that you're going to have to be a part of in order to protect the dog, to keep it out of trouble. And there are certain environments where you can let the dog do the work and kind of stay out of the way. But in the training part of it, the reason I had y'all stand in one place with the leash and let the dog search the rack is because I wanted him to understand, with somebody else standing around, as early as I can, I'm going to start distractions from that point. I'm going to distract him to the point where he says, no, I'm going to follow this and I'm going to get there. I'm going to get paid. They're exactly right. So you're conditioning the dog to work independently and do this itself, and you position yourself where you're in the right place. The herding dogs, you see it the same way. The bird dogs, you see it the same way. But yet when we start training a dog to detect substances, we want to get in the way. We've done so much obedience from the early ages. Obedience, obedience. Jesus. And then, you know, bite work, bite work, bite work. And then all of a sudden we want to do detection. And we feel like it's something we have to physically show the dog what to do. An excellent dog trainer is not one that physically shows the dog what to do, as much as he's an expert at manipulating the environment to allow the animal to learn for himself.
Yes.
And I don't know any clearer way to say it other than that. And until we face that fact, we're going to get 20-30% false alerts all the time, because we train them to do that. The A-frame video that I showed you in the course, where the dog went over, but it was too steep for him to come back.
Yeah.
And everyone thought he was going to go around. He's going to go around it. No, he did. He waited there. He would circle around a couple of times, but he eventually jumped back over the A-frame and came back. He was never allowed to make the mistake. The 6-foot fence that we had up under the A-frame never allowed him to go around another way. He had to go over this way and then back over that way. And once they learn under that pretense, it's a little easier to understand why that happened. We prepared for it. And we don't always prepare for the best things, but we look at what we didn't prepare for, and we learn to prepare for it next time.
Which, when you talked about false alerts, and that's something that I think you and I had talked about way back when, we talked about slick treeing. And you had said, you had mentioned to me that the difference in, and we have it in the hound world now. So that would be the same as a false alert. The dog would be treeing on a tree that either the game went up and come down, not likely a lot of times, or the dog just shortcut the process and said, I want my reward, I'm cheating, and it's here. Mm-hmm. So can you compare the two, how you perceive that?
Yeah, it's like the beagles. Mm-hmm. Anytime they gave behavior consistent with something being in that brush pile, it was always there, Bubba. They didn't have a concept of false alerting or to do something to get what they wanted was the process. What they wanted was the game. And it's really the same way in detection. We provide an environment with the understanding that once you get to that source, you're going to have the game that you live for right there at it. Within being at the source, you know, back a long time ago, we used to have the dog pick up the substance and drop it. Didn't want him really interacting with it as much as picking it up and dropping it, that final step to know that they made the find. Now I don't even do that. Where I've got this pod, which is where I put my substances, and I try to explain to people that the odor within that circumference is kind of like what Shetler talks about as far as a proximity alert.
Mm-hmm.
They know when they're close. They know where the man is when they're close enough to him. They know where the substance is when they're close enough to him. And if I can have that game happen right here within that circumference, there where that substance is, that's what they'll work for. It just makes the picture crystal clear. And if we think he's got to do some particular behavior to satisfy us, and that's when they start turning to us and looking at us for all the answers and following us around. And every time we slow down, we got to keep our feet moving.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. We don't do that no more. We don't do it. We don't do statue of liberty. We don't walk in place. Now, there are some groups that I train, that I go and either certify for or whatever, that still do that. And I scratch my head. But another thing that I took from you or this class is some people have perfected their craft in that method. And it takes a certain dog to fit that mold. And if that dog is not in that mold, then it's not going to work in that method, which again, it's like when you laughed at us and made fun of us, it completely, it's like, well, this is stupid. Why is it? Why are we doing this? And we've not done it since. We've not. And if I catch somebody doing it, I'm calling them out like as fast as I can call them out.
Yeah, it's the things that we thought was necessary. Hold the dog accountable. Accountable for what? Well, he walked the damn source. He walked 20 pounds. Did he walk it or did he not smell it? And if he did walk it, did he have a different preconceived notion as to what he was supposed to do in accordance with the handler and the reward object being delivered? Does that make sense? And it's and that's the kind of stuff we have to stay away. Dog, do it. Set it up to where he can do it. Don't pay him until he does. He drops out of drive. Don't be afraid to pull him slowly out of the room while the trainer behind the rack is agitating him with the ball and put him up. He'll come back with a whole nother attitude later on because his game has been taken from him. I remember in high school, I was playing football and, you know, was in line to earn a scholarship and I dislocated my shoulder in the 11th grade. And I remember when I realized what had happened, because the pain was pretty severe, you know, coach come over and he puts his arm up under my arm and pops it back into place. And I'm sitting there and I'm crying like a baby. Now the pain was over with because, you know, the pain was over with because he put it back into place. And as soon as he does that, it's almost back to normal and you still feel, you know, the damage, but you know, it was kind of back to normal, but yet I'm still crying because I knew my game was going to be taken away from me for a period of 6 to 8 weeks. And it was. That was the hardest thing, you know, really to deal with.
It's, so yeah, I want to back up just for a second. I feel like in the hound world that we guide, we let them get too visual. I mean, their noses are what we use them for. Their noses. That's why they're there. And I feel like a lot of people, and you talked about don't pay him. And that's something that I have learned also, is if the dog's not doing what he's supposed to be doing, and I can't set that environment up for him to be successful, I'm just not going to pay him. It's okay to be unsuccessful. It's actually boosting the drive. Like you just said, And a lot of guys, I think they have a hard time with the failure part, but the best way to learn is through failure.
Well, you hear it all the time. You know, you got to finish on a positive note. No, you don't. No, you don't. Pull his ass out of there. He'll come back later. He'll be in a higher state of mind and be able to learn under his own pretense. All we did was take him and put him up. Yeah. But we have to have the dog that means something to. If we don't have that dog, you pull him out and they're wagging their tail saying, hey, I'll be back next week. It ain't going to work. You know, picking one that has the motor to do whatever it takes to get what it is we have is what we have to look at when we're evaluating and picking a dog. I want to know that he won't. Now, the long range drive as far as the retrieve, good for some people, still works. Might use the ball poppers to do that. I don't know. I want one that has a close range drive. When it does bike work, has that usually, and he has it in conjunction with the sleeve. But you know that if a dog, you know, has that ability, if he has that in him, he's going to bite on Thursday. He's going to bite on next Friday. He's going to bite Tuesday. It doesn't matter. He's got that in him. So if I use that drive to educate the detection work first and compartmentalize it and do it away from where I would do bite work first, then I have the dog have a complete understanding of what it is in each task. Instead of them coming up here looking at the rack, seeing somebody behind the rack, saying, "Ooh, son of a bitch, I'm going to bite you." And goes into the bite work frame of mind. Mm-hmm. Compartmentalize the tracking, compartmentalize the bite work, compartmentalize the detection to a point to where you can communicate with them and let them know exactly what you're doing. It increases the probability of being successful. I used to get mine out of a certain side of the car when he was going to go pee or relieve himself. Mm-hmm. And another side of the car when we're about to do business. Mm-hmm. Every little thing matters. The equipment they have on matters. You know, they associate. Go ahead.
Yeah, so I wanted to go back to being able to communicate with a dog where the dog cannot communicate with you. And you did an exercise with us. And in fact, I still have a handful of those clickers that you had back then. You put us in a room with four or five individuals. Well, you split us up. And talk about that exercise and talk about how important communication is, because the dog cannot tell us to back off.
No, they can't tell us to back off. You know, they're never going to have a comprehension of the English language, regardless of how much profanity we experiment with. They're just not going to know. they live by reinforcement and a signal that lets them know that reinforcement is coming. So this is the nexus. This is a bridge, yeah, between.
That's the Wi-Fi. That's what I call it.
Yeah, that's the Wi-Fi. That's the bridge between our bad timing. We can't get it there quite quick enough. And the dog doing a behavior when he's got his nose right on that source, bam, and then I pay him right close to the source. Not back over here waving the source, at the source. And I think I probably didn't because I didn't have it at that time, but Lauren's dog, when we fed that dog, is always at the same place in the office closet. We call it office closet because it's an office, but we used it as a closet where we kind of fed the dog. And every time we would feed her dog, we fed him right there. And there's a video where I go in and I grab the feed pan. And when I grab the feed pan, it's somewhat of an antecedent toward the dog that makes him realize what's about to happen. He goes over and he stands by the door as I'm hydrating his food. That's a fancy way of saying I put some water in it. But sounds real good, you know. It's kind of like saying cognition five times in one sentence. Oh, it sounds good. But the dog sat over there and waited. He wasn't over there messing with me. Now, had I fed him a couple of juju beans while he does that, he might have been over there messing, but he never did. It was straightforward. He got paid for being at that place. And when I put his food down, it was right there, and boom, he would sit there and eat it until it was done, and he was finished with it. It's shaping behavior. It's a reinforcement history. And doing it a certain way each time and being consistent with that, that causes the dog to realize what this game is all about. The beagles knew that they had to get to the rabbit before it was over with, before they found another one. The detection dog realizes he needs to follow that odor to the source before he can get paid there and then go get another one. And if they know, it's easier to work that. We depend on them knowing what we're about to do. When we're about to track somebody down, it's business. It's business. We got the harness on him or whatever we put on him. We get him out there. And the funny thing is, and I'm sure you've probably seen it too, is when you're about to track somebody, it's almost like they smell a substance doing the detection work. A lot of similarities there. Mm-hmm. And when they take off and go, you know when they're on the track and you know when they're off of it. You've done it enough times, you know, to know. And the biggest thing is the understanding. When I put that on them, this is what we're doing. I went through a forced tracking seminar with one of the gurus in tracking back then. And, you know, it was probably one of the worst decisions I ever made. I'd already tracked three people down with my dog who took to it easily, you know, just by, you know, having somebody walk out there and let him follow them, you know, to the source and then get paid. And the forced tracking confused him so much that I almost lost him over that, you know, as far as doing tracking. Mm-hmm. And You know, it's.
You were using the more natural route other than putting the lead between his legs and forcing him to do step by step.
Yeah. Yeah. And the truth of the matter is, I think both parts, you know, when you're putting the food in each footstep and you're going by disturbance, okay. All right. I got it. But, you know, when the dog's allowed to odor himself to follow it back to the disturbance before he goes forward, those are the dogs that I seem to do the best with. And I always like to get a good Schutzen dog that maybe was a little hard to control, maybe was a little nasty in the blind.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, he didn't give a damn about what the equipment or where it was. That always seemed to make the best dogs because I allowed them to freedom to be obedient to the odor and follow it to the disturbance which led to the source or the individual, instead of, you know, just letting them run all over the place or expecting them to go footstep for footstep.
Mm-hmm.
Combination of both, yeah.
And when you talk about compulsion, because you and I both, even though you were way ahead of me, that was the same way that I was taught. And, you know, I still see it in some of the hound guys. They have dogs that are, you know, they're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you can't, instead of finding a level-headed, clear-minded dog, like, because I see that a lot. The guys that got dogs are just, they're off the charts. The drive is like here, and there's no control in them, really.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you stop and look at that, it's all based on, you know, somebody thinking that they have to do a particular thing in order to pick a dog. They got to have one with a crazy drive instead of one who can think through nice, mm-hmm. nice drives. And if you pick one like that, then you're picking a fight with something you're going to have to fight with all along. But their craziness kind of, you know, it's gets them through the hard parts sometimes because they are crazy. They go in there to grab the guy to get a bite, say, hey, my dog's my good boy, but he's still got that other side to him, that Jekyll and Hyde side. And what you want is the dog that's clearing the head doing this, same mm-hmm. drives. And it takes, you know, some pretty good experience in picking that or recognizing it before you go into training. Now, with really good dogs getting harder and harder to find, it causes people to try to delve over into that side a little bit. And it's, you know, it can cause trouble. But if somebody's got the right handler who's going to, you know, take their time and, you know, treat the dog right, sometimes those work their way out, and then sometimes it just doesn't work its way out. And you know, it's yeah, you see these Malinois, and you know that well, he's been with a couple other departments, but they want to get rid of him, and you wonder, oh, what's the deal? And you know, with the dog, you can't put them on the couch and say, well, you'll. Your mama was a crack hoe and your daddy left home early, so you just ain't going to be worth a damn. It's a dog, and they remember everything that happens to them.
And yes.
If they come through somebody who believes in compulsion a whole lot and they continue, and finally the dog says, I'm not putting up with this bullshit. We bought him because he's got a strong will. We brought him because he's got a strong drive. We bought him because he's got some sense. But then we want to abuse that to try to get him to do a little thing that we want him to do, and he lashes out to protect himself.
Mm-hmm.
Guess which one gets put to sleep.
Yeah.
Guess which one needed to.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just my opinion. I could be wrong.
No. I get calls all the time for people trying to, they get them out. And I always tell them, do not get a Mallee for a pet. You just don't get one. It's not the right dog for you. Mm-hmm. And they get them anyway. And then a year and a half into it, they're calling me, hey, y'all think y'all could use this dog for police work? Cause you know, we just can't handle him. Yeah. I get that. Like we get it. I mean, I probably get those calls weekly.
Well, that, probably a really good way of picking up a few nice dogs because they were puppies. They've come up in a home, they've been socialized, and now they're a little bit too much to deal with. I picked up some really nice dogs like that.
Mm-hmm. But it takes the right person to be able to handle that too.
Oh, it does. It does. Yeah. And that's what we're here for. I mean, we as professionals, you recognize that and see that the dog is better off being somewhere else than with a family type environment. And they fit really well, and they've got to have a job. I mean, it's,
yes.
You take a Malinois, leave him in the kennel the first 6 months of his life, and you got a catastrophe on your hands. They have to get out and be doing something, and their mind has to be stimulated to the point where they figure they can coexist in this world with us. Now, when I say with us, sometimes they're going to be the us part is some idiot who thinks they got to hammer the hell out of them, and then all of a sudden you got an issue, and it doesn't have a happy ending. The guy you were talking about earlier, when you saw him running around the car with a pipe in his mouth, when he said, yep. He said, Randy, I'm going to get CNN out here. I'm tired of hoisting this dog over my shoulder to get him out the damn reward just to get him to let go.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that I told, leave in his mouth, run him around the car. Let's see what happens. He goes around the car, comes back to the other side, pipe's gone. I said, well, what happened to the pipe? You know, I'm thinking to myself, he goes around to where the substance is. The other handler goes around and picks up the pipe and brings it to the actual handler. And, you know, the dog gets to the right place. He gives his indication. The guy throws the pipe in there, gives it to him. And I said, why did he let the pipe go? And the guy said, huh? You know, it's the game's what he wants, not the damn pipe.
Yeah,
and if he's willing to take the ass whipping in order to earn that, that's what he'll do. God, what a shame. What a shame for the dog to have that kind of an understanding as to what he's got to do just to get what he wants. We have to clear that up. We got to get our head out of our asses, put our egos on the shelf, and figure out what it is we have to do in order to communicate with this animal who has a lot of responsibility, but is capable of taking care of that responsibility. Yeah.
And that all goes back to, like, you know, training and learning. You've said it numerous times. I mean, I say it all the time because I picked it up from you and probably 10 other, you know, really good trainers, that you should never be closed-minded. You should always be willing to take something from any type of training, any type of discussion, you know, videos, whatever your learning process is, however it works. Mine are videos, seminars, and seeing a lot of dogs. That's kind of my breakdown. That's kind of my three. Mm-hmm. And I've been blessed to be, you know, to be able to go through, you know, your school and some other people's schools and pick it apart. And I always say it's like a buffet, man. Take what you like, eat it. Mm-hmm. Keep the rest of it on the buffet. So if you need to pull it out of there, you can use it for that next dog or that next dog. And I said it one other time, your mind is best when it works like a parachute and that's fully open.
Yeah. I like the buffet analogy. If you eat something wrong, you'll throw it up.
That's right. Yeah. Or you'll wear it. Like I've done that a couple of times. I've had to wear a few dogs and got scars to show it, but that was my mistake, not theirs.
That was the hardest thing is once I went through and decided I wasn't going to compete anymore, what I did do is I went to every seminar I could get my hands on. If they were doing something with animals, I don't care what it was, I was going to get there and learn what they were doing. And you'd be surprised how much you learn from horse trainers, how much you learn from some of these other guys that are in a different venue, like the bird dogs and the Kelpies and Border Collies, stuff of that nature, who do a lot of herding. You know, it's you can learn from these guys, but they're really good about letting the dog do what he does, and they just put enough to it to get the dog to do it the way they want him to. If you go too far, you've messed it up.
Yeah. And I was sitting here trying to remember. I went to and you talk about other animals. Of course, you know, my family's background is in like a small farm, horses. We had horses. My sister still has them. Of course, my daughter has them. But we went to he was called the Horse Whisperer. Ah, what was his name?
Buck Buchanan.
No.
Hunt.
Who?
Ray Hunt.
I don't know. But anyway, he was in Lexington. So we went up to the horse center. It was me, my dad, my sister. And he literally took a wild like horse that had never had a saddle on. And within that seminar, which it may have been an hour, it could have been two, I don't remember. It's been 20 plus years ago. He literally was riding that horse. Mm-hmm. And it had never been touched. Nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you talk about, you know, watching how people do other animals, I know, you know, you had been to a dolphin and went and watched a dolphin thing. I know you had talked about that. Like, yeah. You can always learn something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was actually Karen Pryor. And I think Gary Wilkes was at that seminar also. And I sat there two or three days, bored to tears until they brought out the clicker and had one of us be the dog like you were explaining a while ago. And I remember as the dog, I'm trying to figure out what this girl's trying to get me to do by listening to the clicker. And hell, she was just sitting there clicking the thing every now and then. But I'm working hard to try to figure out what it was. And I said, well, Mr. Hare, we're going to move this along. Apparently, you don't make the greatest dog or whatever. And I said, well, what was the behavior? They said, well, you were supposed to stick your hands in your pockets. I said, I had my hand in my pockets three different times. She never clicked. She never clicked. And I was pissed. And when I backed up and tried to cool off a little bit, a different set of emotions took over. And as a grown man, I came to tears over what I had put dogs through before, that they didn't understand what was going on. And I had just gone through that same thing. It's a little different when you get in that pelt and you crawl around a little bit.
Yeah. And that's when you put us in the room and had the people talk, you know, they were supposed to click fast if we was on it, slow if we were getting close. And, you know, I don't know how, what time frame you give us, but ours was to turn the light switch on. Uh-huh. That's what ours were, you know, mm-hmm. And everybody's walking around the room. Heck, two of them were standing on the table. I think one of them was sitting in a corner. I don't know what all was going on, but, you know, it's hard to communicate, like, when you don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to communicate when you don't know. And you know, if you can get it across to them, the whole thing is having them understand what it's like to be the dog. And once you truly experience that, it gets to you. It messes everything you did in the past. It comes back to mess with you. And it should. But once you learn that, that's when you start learning from the dogs and things get a little clearer. But you got to put that ego on the shelf.
Mm-hmm.
Go learn and not be afraid. Yeah, there isn't any one individual that I've looked at and said, I'm doing everything his way. And then you go to another and say, I'm doing everything his way. Uh-uh. Take it in. I put it in where I think it's going to work. I might call him and get a little feedback from him. You know, but at the end of the day, I'm going to take what he learned, learn how to apply it, but it only applies to certain dogs that have mm-hmm. that certain drive in order to do it a certain way, for lack of a better way of explaining it. And once we realize that as human beings, then we can become better trainers and realize that we are never going to know it all. I learn mm-hmm. something new in this business every day, buddy.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the point where you think you know it all, it's time to get out of it.
You know, you was talking about egos, you know, the police world will definitely make you take that and put it in your pocket. Because if I don't catch a bear out here, it may hurt my pride a little bit if my buddies are around and my dogs don't do what I've bragged them up to do or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's okay. But when you don't catch that suspect that just, you know, beat up their wife or, you know, ram two police cars and tried to run over a police officer or Lord forbid it was an officer involved shooting. When you don't find them and you've got multiple agencies there, multiple resources and assets, and they're looking for at you to be able to put an end to this, that is a very humbling
mm-hmm.
feeling.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's, and when you talk about humbling, I remember, you know, the first thing I wanted to do when I got into law enforcement, and I really didn't have any desire to be a cop. I wanted to handle a police dog and learn what that was like. I learned a lot about the hounds, handling them, and hunting with them, I wanted to learn about the police dogs. And I thought the best way to do that was to compete in these competitions that would measure my manhood against their manhood to show what I was capable of doing. And all that's okay, I guess. You know, that run and recall is what they said separated the men from the boys. And when you got out there and you trained that run and recall and you had them tied to the long line or the remote call or whatever number of things you did, the dog had to stop with this individual running away from him. And it's a pretty tough thing to do because the dog's in full-blown drive. And, you know, it again is usually the difference between winning and losing the trial. And, you know, I did that and finally got this dog where he would recall and, you know, got rookie dog of the year or something. I can't remember which. But we, you know, we actually had an individual who escaped from prison up in Arkansas, and he was there in Bastrop, Louisiana, and creating havoc. He didn't pistol whipped a couple of people, and you know, just a bad dude. 6'4", run like a deer, built like Tarzan. He just, you know, but rotten to the core. Mm-hmm. And we got information as to where he was, and you know, surrounded the place. And we no sooner got it surrounded than he knew we were out there, and he bust through this window right in front of me, and this 38 goes shooting off to the side. And he gets up and he's looking at the dog, and they're no further than me to the screen, looking at each other. And he's yeah. Well, this guy gets up, hauls ass, jumps over to his car, this little Opel GT, and takes off running. I get to a place where I got a clear line of sight. Once he lines up on him, I hit him on the side, told him to pocket. He takes off after him, and I'm waiting for the screams to start. And they started from the other cops. And stop, wait a moment. Stop, we're going to shoot. Stop. The dog heard all that yelling. What do you think he thought?
Recall. Been there, done that.
Come back and did the most beautiful recall you've ever seen. And looked up at me, guard, and said, hey, you know, how did I do? One of my friends looked at me and said, hey, Hare, why don't you take your trophy out there and show it to that guy? But he was right.
Yep.
And it caused me to reevaluate some things. Never competed again. But if I sent the dog after somebody, I didn't miss any more bites. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have but, you know, 4-5 bites during the whole career. But, you know, I had a lot of apprehensions without the bite, which helps you out when you do have one.
That's right.
But yeah, that's where I changed everything. And I started going and listening to everybody, not just one or two, everybody. Yeah, it's one of the most responsible things you can do.
What's your responsibility to make sure that the dog performs in any circumstance, in any environment, because that's what they're paying you to do.
Right.
And I have failed. I've had the exact same thing happen with mine, and my dog don't have any engagement issues. Like I'm telling you, like straight up, but yeah. Training issue. That was a training issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Big time. It was a training issue and an ego issue. Wanting to, you know, those trophies down there that are downstairs and they're displayed there. People like that when they come in, but it's a walk. It's a walk that I'm not real proud of in a lot of cases. And it's a walk that I learned a lot from. So I'm not sure which one I would take and leave, you know, if I could. But all you can do is, and people say, well, the court's this, the court's that. There's only going to be one person on that stand. It's going to be you. Mm-hmm. And if you can do it to where they can't have an expert witness discredit what you're about, you're ahead of the game. This is not that hard. There's certain things the dog needs to know to do, and your ability to communicate what that is in a timely manner is the difference between success and failure. And the more you do it, the better you get at it.
Yeah. 5 minutes a day. That's all it takes.
That's right.
For me.
Right. Small clips, small increments. Yeah.
That's right. Well, Randy, before we finish this up, just kind of give us your thoughts and your if you have to say something, especially to the guys that are the newcomers about training, what would your advice be then? Because you've been around, you've seen numerous people, numerous dogs, years and years and years of dogs. What would your advice be to them?
The biggest thing I see is young trainers coming up have to portray themselves as if they are already experienced, when we all know that they're not usually. You know, that's something you have to earn. You can't pull it down from the heavens. You can't say, well, I was ordained a trainer back when those rabbits ran from those beagles the first time. I knew I was the only one there. It's one of those things where you build your reputation one client at a time. You take care of their dogs. You're not out there, and I'm talking from experience, not out there chasing girls and all like that. And you're trying to, you know, before long, you have the dog in there 3, 4, 5 days. You haven't done anything with it. Now you got to do it all at one time. And the dog is the one that winds up suffering from it. It's, you know, be yourself. Stop worrying about what everybody thinks about you and build your own reputation. And when you do that, when the years start piling on to each other, you'll be happy about where you're at the end. And I've made those mistakes. They're not fun. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it has to do with maturity and experience.
And you can't train experience, can you?
Nope, it has to be earned.
Yeah.
You gather experience to benefit your knowledge base, and your reinforcement history is the same as a dog's. You know, what you get reinforced with, you're going to continue to do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. And, you know, Lauren just handed me a note about creating your own name. You know, it's, you know, people out there will copy your name and do this and do that. And in the era of social media, you find a lot of that is pretty prevalent. And, you know, it's be yourself, earn your reputation, and enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And don't be afraid to ask for help. Don't be afraid to ask somebody for help.
Yeah. No, if people realized how many, I do it less now, but I still make phone calls. Like, I still call people and ask, hey, what do you think about this? Or what happens? You know, what do you think I should do about this behavior? Or how do I fix this behavior? And if, you know, that's how you learn, and that's how you get better. And if you've got good people around you, again, I mean, the stuff we took from you, and I didn't even realize it until we just started talking, the amount of stuff that we took from your class that we still implement. There's only two people in our group that was there, me and Robbie. And Robbie's the one that set us up at the Boy Scout camp. We're the only two in this training group that are still around when you were there. Everybody else is new.
Yeah.
And the amount of stuff that we still use from that class is like, it's way more than I, you know, playing it back. It's like, well, I'm still doing this. I'm still doing that. I'm still doing this. Am I using the boxes? No, I'm not. I've doing something else, but I'm still doing the same things in a same application, just a different process.
Let me grab something to show you.
Yep. Attention hound hunters and outdoor enthusiasts. Are you ready to experience the thrill of fair chase hunting? If so, check out Southern Hound Hunting Magazine. It's your ultimate guide to all forms of hound hunting, starting in the flat woods of southern Georgia and covering vast terrains across the nation. We bring you genuine stories where the chase is exhilarating as the catch, recipes, and the brag pages that follow. These adventures will take you down memory lane. Whether you're a seasoned pro or a newcomer to the sport, if it's hound worthy, we've got you covered. Join us in this heart-pounding world of hound hunting. To subscribe or to buy the latest swag, go to southernhoundhunting.com. You can also follow along on Facebook and Instagram, where the hunt never ends. Get ready for the real fair chase experience when you join the pack here at Southern Hound Hunting Magazine.
But what I showed you all ago with that pod, or with the sources, this can be done with just a pod, just a hiding place. clicking when the dog gets his nose close and then feeding there at the source and then eventually having a game, you know, at the place. But when you see this and you see the distance from the hole in the top to where the ball actually comes in the bottom, here you go back, is just to create, that's good, is just to create distance between me and the substance. Create distance between me and the dog being rewarded. So when that ball drops down through that hole, it's not about me standing over it or standing next to it. It's about the dog enjoying the game without me being present or being present in a different way. You see what I mean? If I bring the dog away and I'm fighting with him with a towel or what have you, I'm creating value at being with me. When it has to do with this, this is the antecedent. This is the cue. And when they get to the source, they get that with that game at that place. And the game doesn't have to be a war. It can be just tweaks. When the wolf catches the rabbit, unfortunately for the rabbit, they're usually alive while they're being devoured. And all of that movement is happening there. And this has something to do with them understanding the process and enjoying that particular game, even though they don't chase the rabbits like that anymore. And they're not chasing it here. They're after a game that involves a tug. And if we can separate ourselves from that by using the box to create distance, that's what is there. That's why it's there. And it's to separate their eyes and their ears from their nose. I don't want them paying attention to what they see. I want them using that nose, following it to the source. And when they get there, if they turn and look at me and say, "You better have my money," I'm going to get there with their money. And that's where I'm going to pay. And not only am I going to pay, I'm going to be there for about 15, 20 seconds, paying them like this before we leave. And when we leave, I'm not going to pull them out by the ball and the string. I'm going to grab the collar, let go of the ball, and you'll see them drop this and try to beat you back to the source. Because the value is at the source. The value is at the rabbit.
Yep. No, I'm with you. And like I said, we still use a lot of that, a lot more than I realized. So
it's stuff that you can experiment with. And once you start seeing the value of it, and the value has it, a long range dog that just does retrieve is not going to look real good at this. Not going to happen. It's the short range drive that we're able to enjoy and have everything happen within a circumference that doesn't allow failure, or it doesn't entertain failure. There's success pay, but they have to find the place where success comes. They're using their nose and falling to, not somebody running around doing the M&M search and all that bullshit that you've seen before. Mm-hmm. And he passes by and says, "No," he takes him back over there. "You will sit there and sit in this position so I can throw you this ball that you'll be happy with."
So if you guys want to check Randy out, he's got Alpha Dog Canine or Alpha Canine Training Center. It's down in Jackson, Mississippi. He's got a website, videos. You can check it out. And Randy, I can't thank you enough for helping us teach, train, and definitely over the years, the amount of stuff that I personally have learned from you and our group has benefited because of the relationship that I've had with you. So I can't thank you enough.
Well, it's you have to kind of look at this and realize that when you get to a certain age, you know, and all the braggadocio and all that is not as prevalent as it used to be. What becomes more important is what you leave behind, not only to help the individuals who are listening to you, but to help the dogs also to have success. We know that they are capable of amazing things if we get out of the way and let them do it.
That's right. That's right.
Lauren wanted me to mention to you that
yes,
we are not only in Jackson now, we're in Nashville,
Tennessee. Nashville. That's right.
Lauren and I are here in Nashville running this facility, and it's kind of put the quietus on me being able to travel around, but we have a real nice place here, and we have the schools come to us, and it seems to work out very well. I enjoyed the time, you know, that we met. I've always thought a lot of you. I appreciate what you're doing as far as teaching, because people look at that and they learn from it. And there is no greater satisfaction than realizing maybe you helped somebody else get over something that they didn't understand. And And I've had enough people help me and get over stuff that I didn't understand. So, you know, put the egos to the side and let's enjoy the process. Absolutely.
All right. Well, we're definitely doing that. And again, I can't thank you enough because I'm still learning and still taking information that we took from you and still putting it into use. So through you, I'm passing it on.
Well, I'm proud of you and always have been. And hopefully we can get up together and shoot it back sometime.
We definitely will, for sure.
You're listening to the Sportsman's Empire Podcast Network, and this episode is brought to you by Interstate Batteries. For all of your battery needs, visit your local Interstate Batteries retail store. Interstate Batteries, outrageously dependable.